This is Audible.
The Aeneid by Virgil. Translated by C. Day Lewis. Read by David Collins. Book 1. I tell about war, and the hero who first from Troy's frontier, displaced by destiny, came to the Lavinian shores, to Italy. A man much travailed on sea and land by the powers above, because of the brooding anger of Juno, suffering much in war, until he could found a city and march his gods into Latium, whence rose the Latin race, the royal line of Alba, and the high walls of Rome. Where lay the cause of it all? How was her godhead injured? What grievance made the Queen of Heaven so hairy a man renowned for piety, through such toils, such a cycle of calamity? Can a divine being so persevere in anger? There was a town of old, men from Tyre colonized it, over against Italy and Tibermouth, but afar off, Carthage, rich in resources, fiercely efficient in warfare. This town, they say, was Juno's favourite dwelling, preferred to all lands, even Samos. Here were her arms, her chariot, and even from the long-ago time she cherished the aim that this should be, if fate allowed, the metropolis of all nations. Nevertheless, she had heard a future race was forming of Trojan blood, which one day would topple that Tyrian stronghold, a people arrogant in war, born to be everywhere rulers and root up her Libyan empire. So the destiny spinners planned. Juno, afraid of this, and remembering well the old war wherein she had championed the Greeks whom she loved against the Trojans. Besides, she has other reasons for rage, bitter affronts, unblotted as yet from her heart. Deep in her mind rankle the judgment of Paris, the insult of having her beauty scorned, her hate for Troy's origin, Ganymede taken and made a favourite. Furious at these things, too, she tossed all over the sea the Trojans, the few that the Greeks and relentless Achilles had left, and rowed them off from their goal, Latium. Many years they were wandering round the seven seas, moved on by destiny. So massive a task it was to found the Roman race. They were only just out of sight of Sicily, towards deep water, joyfully crowding on sail and driving the foam flocks before them, when Juno, who under her heart nursed that inveterate wound, soliloquized thus, "Shall I give up, own myself beaten? Impotent now to foil the Trojan lord from Italy? Fate forbids me indeed. Did not Athene burn the Argive fleet and drown the crews because one man had given offence, because of the criminal madness of Ajax? Why, she herself flung down Jove's firebolt from the clouds, blasted that navy and capsized the sea with a storm. And Ajax, gasping flame out of his cloven breast, she whisked up in the whirlwind, impaled him on a crag. But I, who walk in majesty, Queen of Heaven, Jove's sister and consort, I must feud with a single nation for all these years. Does anyone worship my divinity after this, or pay my altar a suppliant's homage?" Such were the thoughts milling round in her angry heart as the goddess came to the storm-cloud country, the womb-land of brawling siroccos, Aeolia. Here, in a huge cavern, King Aeolus keeps curbed and stalled, chained up in durance to his own will, the heaving winds and far-reverberating tempests. Behind the bars they bellow, mightily fretting. The mountain is one immense murmur. Aeolus, aloft on his throne of power, sceptre in hand, gentles and disciplines their fierce spirits. Otherwise, they'd be bolting off with the earth and the ocean and the deep sky, yes, brushing them all away into space. But to guard against this, the Father of Heaven put the winds in a dark cavern, and laid a heap of mountains upon them, and gave them an overlord who was bound by a firm contract to rein them in, or give them their head, as he was ordered. Him Juno now petitioned. Here are the words she used. Aeolus, the king of gods and men has granted you the rule of the winds, to lull the waves or lift them. A breed I have no love for now sails the Tyrrhene Sea, transporting Troy's defeated gods to Italy. Lash fury into your winds. Whelm those ships and sink them. Flail the crews apart. Litter the sea with their fragments. 14 nymphs I have. Their charms are quite out of the common. Of whom the fairest in form, Deiopia, I'll join to you in lasting marriage and seal her yours for ever. A reward for this great favour I ask, to live out all the years with you, and make you the father of handsome children. Aeolus answered thus, O queen, it is for you to be fully aware what you ask. My duty is to obey. Through you I hold this kingdom for what it's worth as Jove's viceroy. You grant the right to sit at the gods' table. You are the one who makes me grand master of cloud and storm. Thus he spoke, and pointing his spear at the hollow mountain, pushed at its flank, and the winds, as it were in a solid mass, hurl themselves through the gates and sweep the land with tornadoes. They have fallen upon the sea. They are heaving it up from its deepest abysses, the whole sea, east wind, south, sou'wester, thick with squalls, and bowling great billows at the shore. There follows a shouting of men, a shrilling of stays and halyards. All of a sudden the storm clouds are snatching the heavens, the daylight, from the eyes of the Trojans. Night, black night, is fallen on the sea. The welkin explodes, the firmament flickers with thick and fast lightning, and everything is threatening the instant death of men. At once a mortal chill went through Aeneas and sapped him. He groaned, and stretching out his two hands toward the stars, uttered these words, O thrice and four times blessed you, whose luck it was to fall before your father's eyes under Troy's battlements! O Diomed, the bravest of the Greek kind, why could not I have fallen to death on Ilium's plains and shed my soul upon your sword? Fallen where Hector lies, whom Achilles slew, and tall Sarpedon fell, and Simois, our river, rolls so many helmets and shields and heroes together down its stream. Even as he cried out thus, a howling gust from the north hit the front of the sail, and a wave climbed the sky. Oars snapped. Then the ship yawed, wallowing broadside on to the seas. And then, piled up there, a precipice of sea hung. One vessel was poised on a wave crest. For another, the waters collapsing showed sea bottom in the trough. The tide race boiled with sand. Three times did the south wind spin them towards an ambush of rocks, those sea-girt rocks which Italians call by the name of the altars, rocks like a giant spine on the sea. Three times did the east wind drive them into the Syrtes shoal, a piteous spectacle, hammering them on the shallows and hemming them round with sandbanks. One ship, which carried in her the Lycians and faithful Orontes, before Aeneas' eyes is caught by an avalanche wave and pooped. Her helmsman is flicked from off the deck and headlong sent flying. But three times the vessel is twirled around by the wave ere the waters open and greedily gulp her down. A man or two can be seen swimming the huge maelstrom, with weapons and planks and Trojan treasure spilt on the sea. Now Ilioneus' strong ship, now the ship of valiant Achates, and the ships that carry Abas and aged Aletes go down to the gale. The ships have all sprung leaks and are letting the enemy pour in through the loosened joints of their hulls. Meanwhile, Neptune has felt how greatly the sea is in turmoil, felt the unbridled storm disturbing the water even down to the seabed, and sorely troubled has broken surface. He gazes forth on the deep with a pacific mien. He sees the fleet of Aeneas all over the main, dismembered, the Trojans crushed by waves and the sky in ribbons about them. Juno's vindictive stratagems do not escape her brother. He summons the east and the west winds, and then proceeds to say, "Does family pride tempt you to such impertinence? Do you really dare, you winds, without my divine assent, to confound earth and sky, and raise this riot of water? You, whom I... Well, you have made the storm, I must lay it. Next time I shall not let you so lightly redeem your sins. Now leave, and quickly leave, and tell your overlord this. Not to him, but to me was allotted the stern trident, dominion over the seas. His domain is the mountain of rock, your domicile, O east wind. Let Aeolus be king of that castle, and let him keep the winds locked up in its dungeon." He spoke, and before he had finished, the insurgent sea was calmed, the mob of cloud dispersed, and the sun restored to power. Nereid and Triton, heaving together, pushed the ships off from the sharp rock, while Neptune levered them up with his trident, and channeled away through the sandbanks, and made the sea lie down. Then lightly charioted off over the face of the waters. Just as so often it happens, when a crowd collects, and violence brews up, and the mass mind boils nastily over, and the next thing firebrands and brickbats are flying, hysteria soon finds a missile, that then, if they see some man whose goodness of heart and conduct have won their respect, they fall silent and stand still, ready to hear him. And he can change their temper and calm their thoughts with a speech. So now the crash of the seas died down, when Neptune gazed forth over their face, and the sky cleared, and the father of ocean, turning his horses, wheeled away on an easy course. Aeneas's men, worn out, with a last effort, make for the nearest landing place, somewhere on the coast of Libya. A spot there is in a deep inlet, a natural harbour formed by an island's flanks upon which the swell from the deep sea breaks and, dividing, runs into the land's recesses. At either end of the lofty cliffs a peak towers up formidably to heaven, and under these twin summits the bay lies still and sheltered. A curtain of overhanging woods with their shifting light and shadow forms the backdrop. At the seaward foot of the cliffs there's a cave of stalactites, fresh water within, and seats which nature has hewn from the stone, a home of the nymphs. Here, then, tired ships could lie, and need no cable nor the hooking teeth of an anchor to hold them. Here, with seven ships mustered, all that was left of his convoy, Aeneas now put in. And the Trojans, aching for dry land, tumbled out of their ships onto the sands they craved so, and laid their limbs, crusted with brine, upon the shore. Then first of all Achates struck a spark from flint, nursed the spark to a flame on tinder, gave it to feed on dry fuel packed around it, and made the flame blaze up there. Sick of mischance, the men got ready the gifts and gear of Ceres, setting themselves to roast on the fire and grind, though tainted it was with the salt water, what grain they had salvaged. While this was going forward, Aeneas scaled a crag to get an extensive view of the sea, hoping to sight some Trojan ship, Antheus, perhaps, safe from the storm, or Capys, or the tall ship displaying the shield of Caicus. Ship there was none in view. But on the shore three stags caught his eye as they wandered with a whole herd behind them, a straggling drove of deer which browsed along the valley. Aeneas, where he stood, snatched up the bow and arrows, the weapons he had borrowed just now from faithful Achates, and aiming first at the leaders of the herd, which carried their heads high with branching antlers, he laid them low, then shot at the herd, and his arrows sent it dodging all over the leafy woods. Nor would he stop shooting until triumphantly he had brought down 7 beasts, 1 for each of his ships. Then he returned to the harbour and shared them among his comrades. And then he shared out the wine which good Acestes had casked in Sicily and given them, a generous parting present, and spoke these words of comfort to his sad-hearted friends. "Comrades, we're well acquainted with evils, then and now. Worse than this you have suffered. God will end all this, too. You who have risked the mad bitch Scylla, risked the cliffs so cavernously resounding, and the stony land of the Cyclops, take heart again, oh, put your dismal fears away. One day, who knows, even these will be grand things to look back on. Through chance and change, through hosts of dangers, our road still leads on to Latium. There, destiny offers a home and peace. There, duty tells us to build the second Troy. Hold on, and find salvation in the hope of better things." Thus spoke Aeneas. And though his heart was sick with anxiety, he wore a confident look and kept his troubles to himself. The Trojans set to work, preparing the game for a banquet, hacked the chines apart from the ribs and exposed the guts. Some sliced the meat into steaks which they spitted with trembling fingers. Some set down cooking pots on the beach and fed the fires. Then they restored their strength with the food. Sprawling at ease on the grass, they took their fill of the wine and the rich venison. Afterwards, hunger appeased and the meal cleared away, for a long time they talked of their missing friends, longing to have them back, halfway between hope and fear, not knowing whether to deem them alive or utterly perished and far beyond human call. True-hearted Aeneas grieved especially for the fate of ardent Orontes and Amycus, and the cruel fate of Lycus, grieved for Gaius the brave and for brave Cloanthus. At last they made an end. Jupiter from high heaven looked down at the flights of sails on the sea, and the earth beneath him, its shores and its far-flung peoples. So, at the top of the morning he stood, and presently focused his gaze on the Libyan realm. Now, as he deeply pondered the troubles there, came Venus, sadder than is her wont, her eyes shining with tears, and spoke to him. "Sir, you govern the affairs of gods and men by law unto eternity. You are terrible in the lightning. Tell me, what wrong could my Aeneas or his Trojans have done you, so unforgivable that, after all these deaths, to stop them reaching Italy they are locked out from the whole world? Verily you had promised that hence, as the years rolled on, Troy's renaissance would come, would spring the Roman people and rule as sovereigns absolute over earth and sea. You promised it. Oh, my father, why have you changed your mind? That knowledge once consoled me for the sad fall of Troy. I could balance fate against fate, past ills with luck to come. But still the same ill fortune dogs my disaster-ridden heroes. Oh, when, great king, will you let their ordeal end? Antenor, slipping away through the Greek army, could safely sail right up the Illyrian Gulf, pass by the remote Liburnians, and pass by the source of River Timavus, where tidal water, roaring aloud below rock, spouts up through 9 mouths, and the fields are hemmed with the sound of the sea. He was allowed to found Padua, make a home for Trojans there, could give his people a name, and nail up his arms, could settle down to enjoy peace and quiet. But we, your seed, for whom you sanction a place in heaven, our ships damnably sunk, because of one being's anger we are cheated, and fenced afar from Italy. Is this the reward for being true? Is it thus you restore a king? The begetter of gods and men inclined towards her the smiling countenance which calms the sky and makes fair weather, gently kissed his daughter's mouth and began to speak. Fear no more, Cytherea. Take comfort, for your people's destiny is unaltered. You shall behold the promised city walls of Lavinium and exalt great-hearted Aeneas even to the starry skies. I have not changed my mind. I say it now, for I know these cares constantly gnaw you, and show you further into the secret book of fate. Aeneas, mightily warring in Italy, shall crush proud tribes to establish city walls and a way of life, till a third summer has seen him reigning in Latium, and winter thrice passed over his camp in the conquered land. His son Ascanius, whose surname is now Iulus, Elus it was, before the realm of Ilium fell. Ascanius for his reign shall have full 30 years, with all their wheeling months, shall move the kingdom from Lavinium and make Long Alba his sure stronghold. Here for 300 years shall rule the dynasty of Hector, until a priestess and a queen of Trojan blood, with child by Mars, shall presently give birth to twin sons. Romulus, then, gay in the coat of the tawny she-wolf which suckled him, shall succeed to power and found the city of Mars, and with his own name endow the Roman nation. To these I set no bounds, either in space or time. Unlimited power I give them. Even the spiteful Juno, who in her fear now troubles the earth, the sea, and the sky, shall think better of this and join me in fostering the cause of the Romans, the lords of creation, the togurd people. Thus it is written. An age shall come, as the years glide by, when the children of Troy shall enslave the children of Agamemnon, of Diomed and Achilles, and rule in conquered Argos. From the fair seed of Troy there shall be born a Caesar, Julius, his name derived from the great Iulus, whose empire shall reach to the ocean's limits, whose fame shall end in the stars. He shall hold the east in fee. One day cares ended, you shall receive him into heaven. Him also will mortals pray to. Then shall the age of violence be mellowing into peace. Venerable faith and the home with Romulus and Remus shall make the laws. The grim, steel-welded gates of war be locked. And within, on a heap of armaments, 100 knots of bronze tying his hand behind him, shall sit, growling and bloody-mouthed, the godless spirit of discord. So Jupiter spoke, and sent Mercury down from on high, to see that the land and the new-built towers of Carthage offered asylum to the Trojans. For otherwise might Queen Dido, blind to destiny, turn them away. He aerially wafted, feathering his wings, and post-haste came down on Libyan soil. Now he performs his mission. At the god's will, that people puts by its haughty temper. The queen at once responds to an intimation of peace and goodwill towards the Trojans. True-hearted Aeneas, after a night spent on a treadmill of cares, when kindly dawn came, determined to reconnoitre the strange terrain. Find out to what land the storm had brought them, and who lived there. Was it men or only beasts? For it looked like a wilderness. And bring back a full report to his friends. He saw that the ships were concealed in a woody creek, beneath the overhang of the cliff, with trees and shifting shadows about them, and then set forth, accompanied by Achates only, swinging a couple of broad-tipped spears in his hand. There, from the heart of the woodland, his mother came to meet him, guised as a maiden in face and dress, with a girl's weapons, a Spartan girl, as it might be, or Thracian Harpalyce. outpacer of horses, swift outrunner of running rivers. In huntress wise she had handily slung her bow from her shoulder, and her hair was free to blow in the wind, and she went bare-kneed with the flowing folds of her dress kilted up and securely knotted. She spoke first. "Hello there, young men. If you have seen one of my sisters roving hereabouts, or in full cry after a foaming boar, she carries a slung quiver and wears a spotted lynx skin, please tell me where she went." Thus Venus spoke, and the son of Venus began to reply thus: "No sight or sound have I had of any of your sisters, oh, but what shall I call you, maiden? For your face is unmortal, and your speech rings not of humankind. Goddess, surely you are. A nymph, the sister of Phoebus? Give luck, whoever you be, lighten, I pray, our ordeal. Tell me in what clime, upon what shores of the world we are cast up. For driven here by wind and wave, we have no clue to the peoples or places of our wandering. Tell this, and we will offer sacrifice at your altar." Then Venus said, "Believe me, such titles are not my due. It is the fashion for Tyrian girls to carry a quiver and wear like this the high-laced crimson hunting boot. The kingdom you see is Carthage, the Tyrians, the town of Agino. But the country around is Libya. No folk to meet in war. Dido, who left the city of Tyre to escape her brother, rules here. A long and labyrinthine tale of wrong is hers, but I will touch on its salient points in order. Her husband was Sychaeus, a man of great estates among the Phoenicians, and greatly loved by the ill-starred Dido, whose father had given her in marriage to Sychaeus, a virgin bride. Now the throne of Tyre was held by her brother Pygmalion, a monster who had no rival in wickedness. Maniac evils stepped in. Pygmalion, blinded by love for gold, godlessly murdered the unsuspecting Sychaeus in secret before the altar. No pang of compunction for her love, and kept the deed dark for a long time, vilely inventive of fictions to cheat with hollow hope her pining, loving heart. But there came, one night as she slept, the phantom of her unburied husband, weirdly floating its clay-white face up to her, exposed the atrocious altar, the breast spitted with steel, and took the cover off that crime hidden in the house. Then the phantom urged her swiftly to fly the country, and told her where she could find in the earth an old treasure, a secret hoard of gold and silver to help her on her way. Dido, in great disquiet, organized her friends for escape. They met together, all those who harshly hated the tyrant or keenly feared him. They seized some ships which chanced to be ready, and loaded them with the gold. So was that treasure sailed out of Pygmalion's grasp. A woman led the exploit. They came to this spot, where today you can behold the mighty battlements and the rising citadel of New Carthage, and purchased a site, which was named Bull's Hide after the bargain by which they should get as much land as they could enclose with a bull's hide. But now, tell me who you are, what land you have come from, and whither your journey leads." So Venus questioned him. And Aeneas, sighing, drew up his voice as it were from the heart's depth. "Goddess, if I were to tell our tale right through from the start, and leisure there was to hear the chronicles of our labours, evening would close the sky, and the day be asleep ere I finished. We from old Troy, if ever the name of Troy has come to your ears, were voyaging, when the weather's caprice drove us off our course and piled us onto the Libyan shore. I am true-hearted Aeneas. My fame has been heard of in heaven. I carry my gods of home, which I rescued from the enemy. I go to my own land, Italy, where Jove began our line. With 20 ships I embarked on the Phrygian Sea, my mother, a goddess, showing the way, I following destiny's bidding. But 7 ships now are left us, battered by wind and wave. I, a stranger and needy, now roam the Libyan desert, driven from Europe and Asia." Venus could bear no longer to hear him grieve, and so she broke in on his anguish, saying, "Whoever you are, you cannot breathe and live, I am sure, hateful to heaven, for soon you'll have reached the Tyrian city. Do but fare on, press on from here to the queen's palace. Unless what my parents taught me of signs and omens is meaningless, I can declare your friends rallied to you, your missing ships brought back to haven here by a shift of the wind. Look at those 12 swans flying in jubilant formation. Just now, an eagle swooping from heaven was scattering them all over the sky. But see how in a long line they look down where to land, or where their fellows already have landed, and romping aloft with their wings whooping, and wheeling about the sky in company and calling. Even so it is with your ships and your young warriors. Either they're havened already, or running free to the harbour mouth. Do but fare on, and firmly step where the road leads you." She spoke. She turned away. And as she turned, her neck glowed to a rose flush. Her crown of ambrosial hair breathed out a heavenly fragrance. Her robe flowed down, down to her feet. And in gait she was all a goddess. Aeneas recognized his mother, and as she passed from him, sent these words in her wake. "Must you, too, be cruel? Must you make game of your son with shapes of sheer illusion? Oh, why may we not join hand to hand, or ever converse straightforwardly?" Thus he reproached her, and turned his steps toward the battlements. But Venus folded them as they went in an opaque mist, magically poured round them an ample cloak of cloud, lest any should spy or encounter Aeneas and Achates, attempt to delay them, or demand to know their business. Then she herself was gone through the air to Paphos, joyfully homing again where her temple is, and 100 altars glow with Sabaean incense and blow with fresh-breathed flowers. Meanwhile, the two pressed on apace where the track pointed. And now they were climbing a hill whose massive bulk looms over the city and commands a prospect of soaring towers. Aeneas marvels at great buildings where once were shanties, marvels at city gates and the din of the paved streets. The Tyrians are busy at work there, some extending the walls, manhandling blocks of stone and building the citadel, others choosing a site for a house and trenching foundations. Laws are being made, magistrates and a parliament elected. Here they dig out a harbour basin. Here they are laying foundations deep for a theatre, and hewing from stone immense columns to grace one day a tall proscenium. So, in the youth of summer throughout the flowering land, the bees pursue their labours under the sun. They lead a young brood from the hive, or press the flowing honey and fill the cells to bursting with a delicious nectar. Relieve incoming bees of their burden, or closing ranks, shoo the drones, that work-shy gang, away from the bee folds. The work goes on like wildfire. The honey smells of thyme. "Ah, fortunate you are, whose town is already building," Aeneas said, and gazed up at the city's heights. Then, in his cloak of darkness, he went, a miraculous thing, into their midst, and joined the crowds, but none perceived him. There was a grove, most genial its shade, at the city centre, just where the Carthaginians, after their rough passage, first dug and found the sign which royal Juno had promised, the skull of a spirited horse. It was a sign that henceforth their nation would thrive in wealth and war throughout the ages. Dido was building here, in Juno's honour, a huge temple, made rich by offerings and the indwelling presence of Juno. Bronze was its threshold, approached by a flight of steps. The doorposts were braced with bronze, and the door with its grinding hinges was bronze. This grove had seen Dido's fear allayed by a chance of renewal for the first time. And here Aeneas first dared to hope for salvation and believe that at last his luck was turning. For while he awaited the queen and his eyes roved over the detail of that immense facade, amazed by the town's good fortune, admiring the skill of the rival craftsmen, the scope of their work, he noticed a series of frescoes depicting the Trojan War, whose fame had already gone round the world. The sons of Atreus were there, and Priam, Achilles too, hostile to both. Aeneas stood, wept. "O Achates, is there anywhere, any place left on earth unhaunted by our sorrows? Look, Priam! Here, too, we find virtue somehow rewarded. Tears in the nature of things, hearts touched by human transience. Then cast off fear. The fame of our deeds will ensure your welfare." He spoke, and fed his soul on those insubstantial figures, heavily sighing, the large tears rivering down his cheeks. Pictured there, he beheld scenes of the fight round Troy. Here the Greeks fled with the Trojan warriors hard behind them. Here fled the Trojans before the chariot of plumed Achilles. He recognized, through his tears, not far away, the snow-white tents of Rhesus, taken by surprise, while all slept deep, and wrecked with terrible slaughter by Diomed, man of blood, and Diomed driving away to his camp the fiery horses before they could graze the meadows of Troy or drink the Xanthus. Another scene was of Troilus in flight, his weapons gone. Unhappy the lad, unequal the fight with Achilles. His horses are bolting. Heels overhead, he hangs backwards out of the chariot, yet gripping the reins. His neck and his hair are being dragged along over the ground, and his trailing spear-point scribbles in the dust. Meanwhile, to the shrine of their goddess, their foe's friend, the Trojan women are walking to make intercession. Their hair is unbound, they carry the goddess's ritual robe, they mourn and beat their breasts. But the goddess keeps her eyes on the ground and regards them not. Thrice round the walls of Troy Achilles has dragged Hector, and now is demanding a ransom of gold for the lifeless body. At this point Aeneas uttered a deep groan to see the spoils, the chariot, the actual body of his friend, and Priam's defenseless hands stretched out to Achilles. He noticed himself, too, in the forefront of the battle, noticed the Ethiopian brigade and the arms of Black Memnon, picked out Penthesilea leading the crescent shields of the Amazons and storming through the rack like a fire, her bare breast thrusting out over the golden girdle, a warrior queen, a girl who braved heroes in combat. Now, while Aeneas viewed with wonder all these scenes, and stood at gaze, rooted in a deep trance of attention, there came in royal state to the temple a crowd of courtiers attending her, Queen Dido, most beautiful to see. As by the banks of Eurotas, or over the Cynthian slopes, Diana foots the dance, and a thousand Oreads following weave a constellation around that arrowy one, who in grace of movement excels all goddesses, and happiness runs through the still heart of Latona, so Dido was. Even so, she went her radiant way through the crowds, eager to forward the work and growth of her realm. Now, at the holy doors, under the temple porch, hedged by the spears of her guard, she throned herself on high, gave laws and ordinances, appointed the various tasks in equitable proportions, or else by drawing lots. Just then, all of a sudden, Aeneas saw approaching, amid the multitude, Antheus, Segestus, valiant Cloanthus, and other Trojans, whom the black hurricane had sundered at sea and driven afar to different beaches. He and Achates together were thrilled through, were dumbfounded with anxious joy. They eagerly yearned to join hands with their friends, but the mystery of the whole affair disquieted them. So they keep dark, and peering out from their womb of cloud, speculate what befell these friends, where their ships are beached, why they are here. For spokesmen from each of the ships were coming to sue the queen's favour, and shouting aloud as they neared the temple.
When they had entered, and Dido had granted to them an audience, the eldest, Ilioneus, began in collected tones,
O queen, who under God have founded a new city and curbed the arrogance of proud clans with your justice, we hapless Trojans, wanderers over a world of seas, implore you, stop your people from wickedly burning our ships. God-fearing men we are, incline your heart to spare us. We are not come as pirates to waste your Libyan homes with the sword, and carry down their plunder to the beaches. We've no mind for marauding. The conquered lack such effrontery. There is a place, the Greeks call it Hesperia, an antique land well warded, possessed of a rich soil. Oenotrians colonized it, whose heirs, so rumour says now, have named it after their first founder, Italy. That was our bourne. But rainy Orion rose, and the sea got up of a sudden. We drove on chartless shoals. The winds wantonly pitched us far apart on the deep, amid toppling waves and unchanneled reefs. A handful of us have drifted to your shores. What manner of men are these? What land is this that allows them such barbarous ways? They bar us even from the sanctuary of the sands. They threaten and forbid us to touch the hem of their country. If humankind and mortal arms mean nothing to you, think of the gods. They do not forget good deeds and bad. Aeneas was our king. Never was a man more just, more duteous of heart, more adept in warlike arts than he. If destiny has preserved him, if still he breathes the air of day and is not sleeping in death's unwelcome shade, we need not fear, and you should have no cause to regret that you were prompt to aid us. In Sicily, too, we have towns and resources, and noble Acestes who comes of Trojan stock. We pray you, let us lay up the vessels the storm shattered, and shape new oars and timbers for them out of your forests, so that, if we are meant to get back our friends and our king and make for Italy, to Italy we may go. But if that hope is lost, if the Libyan sea has drowned you, Lord Aeneas, and there's no future for Aeolus, we may at least sail back to our last port of call, to Sicily, where homes are ready for us, and make Acestes our king. Ilioneus stopped speaking. A shout of assent rose from the Trojans all. Then Dido, with her eyes downcast, addressed them briefly. Trojans, put fear away from your hearts and forget your troubles. Mine's a hard task with a young country. That's why I have to do such things, to guard my frontiers everywhere. Who has not heard of Troy and the men of Aeneas, their manly virtues, and all that famous conflagration of war? We Carthaginians are not so insensitive of heart, nor is our city quite so out of the way or benighted. Whether your choice is great Hesperia, land of Saturn, or you decide upon Sicily and King Acestes, I will give you an escort there, and what provision you need. Or would you like to share my kingdom on equal terms? This city I am building, it's yours. Draw up your ships, then. There shall be no preference, I say, between you and us. Oh, if only your king Aeneas himself could come here, fetched by the same storm. Well, I will send couriers abroad with orders to comb the furthest corners of Libya, in case he is wandering somewhere, in woods or towns, a castaway. Arrested by Dido's words, Aeneas and brave Achates for some time now had been on fire to slough off their cloak of darkness. Achates first spoke urgently to Aeneas. "Tell me, goddess-born, what idea forms in your mind now? All is saved, you can see. Our fleet and our friends restored to us. One only is missing, and him we saw drowned in the welter before our eyes. All else bears out what your mother told us." These words were hardly spoken when, in a flash, the cloud cloak they wore was shredded and purged away into pure air. Aeneas was standing there, in an aura of brilliant light, godlike of face and figure. For Venus herself had breathed beauty upon his head, and the roseate sheen of youth on his manhood, and a gallant light into his eyes. As an artist's hand adds grace to the ivory he works on, as silver or marble when they're plated with yellow gold. So then Aeneas addressed the queen, and startling them all, at once began, "I am here before you, the one you look for, Trojan Aeneas, saved from out the Libyan sea. O lady, you alone have pitied the tragic ordeal of Troy, and now you offer to share your home and city with us, the remnant of Troy, men utterly spent by every disaster on land and sea, deprived of everything. Dido, we have not the means to repay your goodness, nor have any of our kin, wherever they are, scattered over the world. If spirits there be who look after the good, if indeed just dealing and minds informed with the right mean anything to heaven, may God reward you as you deserve. What happy age, what great parentage was it gave life to the like of you? So long as rivers run to the sea, and shadows wheel round the hollows of the hills, and star-flocks browse in the sky, your name, your fame, your glory shall perish not from the land wherever I am summoned to go." He spoke. He stretched out his right hand to Ilioneus, his friend, and his left to Serestus, then to others, brave Gaius and brave Cloanthus. Sidonian Dido, amazed first by the man's appearance, then by the magnitude of his downfall, thus addressed him, "O goddess-born, what doom is pursuing you through so many hazards? What violent fate casts you on this harsh coast? Are you the famed Aeneas, whom gentle Venus bore to Trojan Anchises by the waters of Simois? Indeed I well recollect Teucer coming to Sidon, an exile from his homeland, and seeking a new kingdom with the help of Belus. At that time Belus, my father, was sacking rich Cyprus, and holding the island down in subjection to him. Now from that time I have known about the fall of Troy, and known your name, Aeneas, and the kings who led the Greeks. Even their enemy held the Trojans in high esteem, and claimed blood kinship with the ancient line of Troy. So, gentlemen, do not hesitate to come under my roof. I, too, have gone through much. Like you, have been roughly handled by fortune. But now at last it has willed me to settle here. Being acquainted with grief, I am learning to help the unlucky." She spoke. She led Aeneas into the royal palace, and ordered a thanksgiving service to be held in the god's temple. Besides, she sent to his companions on the shore 20 bulls, 100 head of bristle-backed swine, 100 fatted lambs together with their ewes, and the good cheer of the wine god. Within, the palace was being arrayed in all the glitter of regal luxury, and a banquet being made ready. Richly embroidered the hangings of princely purple, a service of solid silver on the tables, and golden vessels chased with the legends of family history. A long lineage of glory traced through many heroes right from its earliest source. Aeneas, whose love for his son would not allow a moment's delay, now sent Achates running down to the ships, bade him tell Ascanius the news and return with him, Aeneas being always thoughtful for his dear son Ascanius. They were to bring back also some gifts, which had been salvaged from Troy's ruins, a robe of stiff golden brocade, and a veil with a pattern of yellow acanthus round its border. Argive Helen had worn them once, and brought them with her out of Mycenae when she eloped to Troy for that lawless marriage. They were a marvellous gift from her mother, Leda. In addition to these, a sceptre, which Ilione, the eldest daughter of Priam, had carried once, a pearl necklace, and a double coronet of gold and precious stones. With this commission, Achates hurried down to the ships. But Venus was meditating a new and artful scheme, which was to substitute for little Ascanius, Cupid, changed into his likeness, and let Cupid inflame the queen with those gifts and set a match to her very marrow. For Venus felt uneasy about her hospitality and Tyrian equivocation. The thought of Juno irked her, recurring at nightfall. So she talks to her winged Cupid. "My son, my only strength, sole agent of my powers, my son who laughs at the bolts of giant-killing Jove, to you I come for a favour, petitioning your godhead. Your own brother, Aeneas, is being tossed about from shore to shore, a victim of Juno's brutal resentment. This you know well, and often have shared my grief at it. Now Carthaginian Dido clings to him and delays him with flattery. I fear the results of kindness inspired by Juno. She'll not give up when so much hinges on this. Her I mean to forestall by ruefully taking the queen's heart and throwing a cordon of fire round it. No deity may swerve her if she is mine, possessed by love for Aeneas. Now, listen to my plan, how you can do this thing. Sent for by his dear father, the royal child, the apple of my own eye, makes ready to go to Dido's city, with gifts for her, things that escaped the sea and the blaze of Troy. Him I shall hide away, drugged with sleep, in one of my holy places, on high Cythera or on Idalium, lest he gain knowledge of my plot or interfere. Do you impersonate him for the space of one night only? A boy yourself, put on that boy's familiar features, so that when Dido takes you joyfully into her lap, there at the banquet table with the wine passing round, and when she hugs you close and pours sweet kisses upon you, then you may secretly fire her heart and inject your magic. Cupid obeyed the words of his dear mother. He took off his wings and walked rejoicing in the gate of young Ascanius. But Venus showered a dew of peaceful sleep on the limbs of Ascanius, snuggled him in her breast, and divinely bore him up to Idalian groves, where the tender marjoram puts him to bed in a cradle of flowers and shade and entrancing fragrance. And now, as his mother had bade him, Cupid was on his way, carrying the kingly gifts and delighted to walk with Achates. When he arrived, the queen had taken her place in the midst and reclined on her golden couch beneath a magnificent awning. Aeneas and his Trojan followers now assembled, disposed themselves upon the purple upholstered couches. Manservants brought round water to wash their hands and offered bread in baskets and gave out napkins of fine wool. Within there were 50 maids, whose task it was by rote to keep up the kitchen fire and a good supply of victuals. 100 maids and 100 manservants, all of the same age, were there to load the banqueting tables and set the wine cups. Carthaginians, too, great numbers of them, were met in the festive hall, invited to sit at the painted couches. They admire the gifts of Aeneas, admire the boy Ascanius, or rather, the radiant looks and plausible speech of Cupid, admire the robe and the veil with its pattern of yellow acanthus. But above all, poor Dido, fated to be destroyed, can't slake her soul with gazing, and in the gazing grows ever more ardent, moved alike by the boy and the gifts. Cupid, when he had put his arms round Aeneas' neck and been embraced, appeasing the love of his feigned father, went to the queen. With her eyes, with all her heart, she devoured him, fondled him oft in her bosom. Poor Dido, little she knew the strength of him who was settling insidiously there. But Cupid, obeying his mother, began to efface little by little the memory of Sychaeus from Dido's mind, and tempt her disused, long-slumbering heart to awake to a living love. When first there was a lull in the feast, and a course was removed, great bowls of wine were brought to the tables and garlanded. A rumble of talk went up, the wide hall surged with voices. The chandeliers that hung from the gold-fretted ceiling were lit, and cressets of torches subdued the night with their flames. The queen now called for a goblet of gold, jewel-encrusted, and filled it up with wine, a goblet Belus had used and all his heirs. Then did the company fall silent. "Jupiter, yours, they say, are the laws of hospitality. Grant this be a happy day for the Carthaginians and those who come from Troy, a day that our children will remember. May Bacchus, giver of joy, be here, and bounteous Juno. And you, my people, bless our feast with friendly hearts." With these words, Dido poured a libation of wine on the table, and after the toast was first to touch her lips to the goblet, then passed it to Bitias with a challenge, who eagerly drained the foaming golden cup, left not a drop within it. Next, other chieftains drank. Then the long-haired Iopas, a pupil of Atlas, made the hall hum with his golden zither. He sang of the travelling moon and the sun's manifold labours. He sang the creation of man and beast, of fire and water. Arcturus he sang, and the rainy Hyades, and the twin bears. The reason why winter suns race on to dip in the ocean, and what slows down the long nights. Round and round of applause came from the Carthaginians. The Trojans followed suit. Yes, and ill-starred Dido talked on into the small hours, talked over many things as she drank deep of love, asking over and over again about Priam and Hector, asking about the armour the son of Aurora had come in, the points of Diomed's horses, and the stature of great Achilles. "But now, dear guest, tell us, please tell us from the beginning the story of Greek stratagems, and how your comrades fell, and your own wanderings, for now is the seventh summer that over land and sea you have been widely wandering." Book 2. All fell silent now, and their faces were all attention, when from his place of honour Aeneas began to speak. "O Queen, the griefs you bid me reopen are inexpressible. The tale of Troy, a rich and a most tragic empire erased by the Greeks. Most piteous events I saw with my own eyes, and played no minor part in it. What Myrmidon or Thessalian, what soldier of fell Ulysses could talk about such events and keep from tears? Besides, the dewy night drops fast from heaven, and the declining stars invite to sleep. But if you want so much to know what happened to us, and hear in brief a recital of Troy's last agony, although the memory makes me shudder and shrink from its sadness, I will attempt it. Broken in war, and foiled by fate, with so many years already slipping away, the Greek staff constructed a horse, employing the craft of the goddess Athene. It was high as a hill, and its ribs were made from planks of pine wood, to pay for their safe return to Greece, they pretended. This rumour got round. But choosing warriors by lot, they secretly put them in on the blind side of the horse, until its vast and cavernous belly was crammed with a party of armed men. In sight of Troy, there's an island, a well-known island, Tenedos. Rich and powerful it was, while Priam's empire stood. Now, little but a bay, a roadstead, unsafe for shipping. Thither, the Greeks sailed out, and hid on its desolate coast. This was evacuation, we thought. They had sailed for Greece. So all Troy threw off the chains of her long anguish. We opened the gates. We enjoyed visiting the Greek camp, viewing the derelict positions on the abandoned beaches. Here the Dolopes camped, there ferocious Achilles. Here was beached their navy, and here the battle raged. Some of us gaped at the gift, so deadly, the Greeks had left for Minerva, and its stupendous bulk. Thymoetes first, either from treachery or because Troy's fate now was sealed, urged that the horse be brought through the walls and placed in our citadel. But Capys and all those of sounder views recommended hurling it into the sea or setting fire to it, as some booby-trap of the Greeks and not to be trusted, or else boring holes in its belly to see what might be inside it.